This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. The Democratic National Convention ended last night. The Republicans get their turn on TV next month. Meanwhile, in the movies, a political convention figures in the plot of The Manchurian Candidate, a new movie remake starring Denzel Washington, now in theaters. On today's Fresh Air, we'll revisit the original controversial 1962 Manchurian Candidate and replay interviews with the late director John Frankenheimer, with Angela Lansbury, who played the part Meryl Streep plays in the new version, and with co-star Liev Schreiber. We'll also have film critic David Edelstein's review of the remake. But first, let's look at political conventions and drama on the small screen, and how and where the Democratic National Convention played out. On commercial broadcast TV, the convention show was more like a no-show. Half of the networks, Fox, UPN, and the WB, didn't cover the convention at all. Even the major networks, CBS, NBC, and ABC, each devoted only 3 hours over 4 nights to primetime coverage. They decided beforehand that Tuesday night wasn't worth showing at all. And by making that decision in advance, they missed one of the most riveting and significant events of the entire Democratic convention, the keynote speech by rising Democratic star Barack Obama, which turned him instantly into a major future political player. If you saw the speech live, you were witness to a bit of history, and not an insignificant bit. But to see it, you had to be watching PBS or tuned to cable. C-SPAN, which shows everything gavel to gavel, presented Obama's entire speech. So did CNN, MSNBC, Fox News Channel, and even ABC News Now, the brand new digitally streamed news operation from ABC. Peter Jennings did a lot of good work there at this convention, but very little of it was seen on his main over-the-air network. Jennings could even be seen yesterday on CNN, interviewed by former ABC colleague Anderson Cooper. He was defending his passion for the American political process and attacking his own network's decision to televise so little of it.
You just come back from Iraq. Does it, having been there, does it change the way you look at this, the way you look at this process at all? I mean, does it, I mean, for me, it actually kind of made me, I think it's easy to be cynical about this process, easy to be cynical about what's happening here.
It made you feel romantic about it.
It did, in a way, yeah.
Yeah, you see, you and I have similar experiences. We've both been in many, many parts of the world where power is exchanged on the barrel of a gun. Right. Some guy brings up his tank and the government changes. That still happens in many parts of the world. In the time I served overseas, it happened all the time. So I think when you come home and participate in the democratic process, even vicariously as journalists do, I think it's extraordinarily moving.
The broadcast networks, you guys have gotten a bad rap lately. I mean, you know, you're broadcasting 3 hours of coverage all this week.
It's not enough.
Though you're doing this digital television, which I want to talk about in a moment.
It's not enough.
It's not enough.
No, of course not. When Barack Obama was on the television the other night.
Yeah, it wasn't carried live by the networks.
I know. Our network, I'm sorry to say, was in a rerun of a program that I don't know which one it was. But
does
I
it
just,
embarrass you?
No, it actually makes me a little angry. And that's why, on the other hand, because life is.
The rerun to which Jennings was referring, by the way, was a repeat of the canceled sitcom I'm With Her. Viewers who don't subscribe to cable and didn't turn to public television saw less live convention coverage this week than at any time in TV history. That history began in 1948, when both CBS and NBC offered to East Coast stations live coverage of the 3 national political conventions from Philadelphia. Back then, they even covered the Progressive Party. Political conventions today are tightly scripted and controlled, and major events that used to happen at conventions, like the choosing of candidates, now happen months beforehand. Yet we can learn a lot from the way each party chooses its speakers and crafts its image, and who is and isn't considered a ready-for-primetime player. And no matter how firmly things are controlled, there always will be surprises. Like Barack Obama, Al Sharpton. And lurking in the shadows, getting more TV time at this convention than most politicians, Ben Affleck, and especially Michael Moore. On Tuesday, when Moore showed up on the Fox News Channel to swap questions with Bill O'Reilly on The O'Reilly Factor, it was big news and drew more viewers than any other moment of convention coverage that night. By Thursday, another Michael Moore sighting was just that, one more sighting. I watched the convention on 12 TV screens, each tuned to a different network. And at times, it seemed like Michael Moore was crawling out of one screen directly into another. The one I remember most, though, is his exchange with host Ted Koppel on ABC's Nightline.
Do you feel just a little bit uncomfortable about the influence that you may have on this election?
No, not at all. I'm glad to participate. I'm glad to offer this. You know, geez, I feel very lucky, Ted, to be able to make this contribution. You know, growing up in Flint, Michigan, I have a high school education. I never would expect to be sitting here even talking to you. I mean, it's all
life,
this.
Life is amazing, isn't it? God,
well,
the things you get to do in this country.
Yeah, well, that's why we love it, isn't it? You know, some people get to be Ted Koppel, and some people get to talk to Ted Koppel. I love this country.
I mean, after you make your next 100 million, are you going to shave?
After I make the next 100 million, I'll be Ted Koppel.
You wouldn't want that.
Both of the segments I've chosen from this year's convention coverage feature members of the media talking to one another. There were more of those this week than I've ever seen before, going so far down the journalistic food chain that TV reporters spent way too much time interviewing bloggers, internet writers of informal diaries. One blogger, interviewed on ABC News Now, reported, and I quote, "VIP room, cash bar, what's up with that?" The networks have a month until the Republican National Convention at the end of August to get it right. But they won't. Even if only to be fair, the networks will approach the Republicans pretty much the same way and for the same paltry amount of live primetime coverage. 6 networks, 3 hours. What's up with that? I'm David Bean Cooley. The Manchurian Candidate, Jonathan Demme's remake of the gripping political thriller from 1962, opens today in theaters. Denzel Washington plays Ben Marco, a Gulf War veteran plagued by disturbing dreams. Liev Schreiber plays Raymond Shaw, another member of Marco's unit during the Gulf War, who is now an up-and-coming young congressman from New York. And Meryl Streep plays Shaw's ambitious mother, Eleanor, whose husband Johnny, Shaw's stepfather, is also running for office on the ticket for president. The original movie, made in the aftermath of the McCarthy-era witch hunts and in the early volatile years of the Cold War, starred Frank Sinatra as the troubled Marco, the role now played by Denzel, Lawrence Harvey as war hero Raymond Shaw, and Angela Lansbury as Shaw's mother. The movie was directed by John Frankenheimer, who died in 2002 at age 72. Let's get a taste of the original. In this scene, Raymond Shaw, played by Lawrence Harvey, is touring his stepfather Johnny's new campaign plane. Angela Lansbury, as Shaw's mother, is showing off the plane, but her son doesn't intend to stay on it.
I'm not going home with you, Mother. I'm going to New York.
What?
I've got a job in a newspaper. Research assistant to Mr. Hoban Gaines.
Hoban Gaines? That communist?
He's not a communist, Mother. As a matter of fact, he's a Republican.
But the terrible things he's written about Johnny.
He came to interview me at the White House this morning. Afterwards, I asked him for a job. He gave it to me. We discovered that we had a great deal in common.
What could you possibly have in common with that dreadful old man?
Well, for one thing, we discovered that we both loathe and despise you and Johnny. And that's the beginning.
John Frankenheimer started his career in TV in the 1950s, directing such golden age TV dramas as the classic Days of Wine and Roses for Playhouse 90. His films included The Birdman of Alcatraz, 7 Days in May, French Connection 2, Black Sunday, and more recently, Ronin and Reindeer Games. Terry spoke with Frankenheimer in 1990.
There's a scene I have to ask you about. It's really an extraordinary scene. This is the Garden Club dream scene. Frank Sinatra is having these recurring nightmares in which he's with all of the men from his army troop from the Korean War. He's with them at a ladies' garden club, and suddenly the ladies' garden club turns into a lot of Korean soldiers, and the head Korean soldier is discussing how he's brainwashing these soldiers into believing that they're at a garden party. And then to show how brainwashed they really are, he has Lawrence Harvey just walk over and strangle to death one of the men. You shot that scene in such a disorienting way. The camera just kind of revolves around all the women of the garden club first, and then suddenly the women are transformed into men, and you're as confused as Frank Sinatra is by all of this. Tell me about how you decided to shoot this scene.
Well, number one, the idea of the scene came right out of Richard Condon's book. He described pretty well what the scene should look like. So it was up to me to interpret it. And the shot that you're talking about is a 360-degree shot, which starts on the stage of a hotel in New Jersey where a woman is talking about hydrangeas, and we pan around the room, and you think that it's just women listening to this, a garden club. And then as the camera completes its 360-degree arc, you suddenly find yourself on a stage in an amphitheater in Korea, and the Chinese psychiatrist is talking about brainwashing. So what we did was we designed a set that could be moved, and it took a little athletic ability from the actors to run from one platform to the other while we were back on the garden club. And the two platforms were on a kind of a railroad track, and we slid one right in place as the camera moved off the first one. But what it did was it set in the audience's mind that this was not just the magic in the movies, that something very strange here was happening, because we never cut. And the audience realizes when you cut. They might not know what it is, but they know that there's been some mechanical device put between them and the story. And I wanted to do it all in one shot. And I think after we accomplished that shot, then we were able to cut to anything that we wanted to do. And we filmed that sequence with about 7 or 8 different combinations. The women in Korea, the Chinese Manchurian delegates in New Jersey, the actors on the New Jersey stage, hotel, the actors in the Korean amphitheater. And we were able to intercut it at will, back and forth. And after the first shot, the suspension of disbelief with the audience was complete. So we were able to kind of manipulate them back and forth whenever we wanted to. And you're right, we did cut it in such a way that it was confusing, and deliberately so.
Now, one of the black men from this same troupe that Sinatra was in has the same dream. But when he has the dream, all of the women from the ladies' club are black. Was that in the novel, or is that your invention, to have the two people have their own version of this same dream?
That was me. What I never did do, I mean, I had it done, but I just didn't dare take the shot of it. In the back of the room, we had a white bellboy. But we never did show it. If you look carefully, you can see it.
That's great. It's a wonderful... It's wonderful the way you contrast the two dreams.
You know, I want to tell you one other thing about that movie. That's something that I don't think people are aware of, but I think it's important to say in these days and times, which is that that was one of the first movies where the producer and director used a black actor to play a part that was not written for a black.
Uh-huh. Huh?
Today it's done quite often, but that was very new at the time, to take the black actor, cast him as the psychiatrist, and that part was not written for a black actor. I've since done it quite a bit, but I just wanted to bring that up.
You were the co-producer of the movie. I assume that means that you were one of the people who were behind making it, as opposed to a director who was brought on after the idea.
Yes, in this particular case, George Axelrod and I bought the book. We developed it, and then I ended up directing it, of course.
How did Sinatra get involved with the movie?
Well, Sinatra was the whole element that made the movie possible. The movie had been turned down by every studio in town. And when George Axelrod and I bought the book, we bought it by buying the book in a bookstore. It had been optioned and reoptioned and dropped and never been able to be made. And we knew that Frank Sinatra had read the book, and Frank Sinatra was interested in the picture, but he had never really gone the whole 9 yards and optioned it. So we optioned it, and without a script, Frank Sinatra committed to it. And, of course, right away, as soon as he committed to it, we had the necessary financing to make the movie.
Did you have any idea he'd be as good as he was in it? I mean, did you have as much faith in his acting abilities when you started?
No. I didn't want to make the movie with Frank Sinatra. I was scared of it. I had heard he was very difficult. I had heard that he treated directors badly, all those things. I expressed these reservations to George Axelrod, and he said, look, he said, I'm going to make the movie with Frank Sinatra, whether you do it or whether you don't. He said, I'll buy you out, but I want to make this movie with Sinatra. Sinatra's going to get this picture made. And if you have problems with Sinatra, he said, I would suggest that you discuss them with him, instead of discussing them with me. And I made an appointment to see Mr. Sinatra. I went up to see him at his house, and I expressed my reservations to him. And he said, look, I guarantee you whether what you've heard is true, whether what you've heard is not true, there is my side to all that, too. He said, I want to do this picture, I want to work with you, and I feel that we're going to get along just fine. And that was the last discussion we ever had. We got along absolutely fabulously. I loved working with Frank Sinatra.
You've done several films about the military, 7 Days in May, The Manchurian Candidate. You went to military school as a child, right?
Yes, it's true.
Did you feel like that gave you insights into the military mind at all?
Yes, I do. And I also was a lieutenant in the Air Force, and I was General LeMay's personal photographer during the Korean War and things like that. And yes, I do. I feel that it's given me a tremendous insight into the military mind, especially on higher levels, because I was around general officers a lot. And it's helped me.
When you were General LeMay's personal photographer during the Korean War, what did that entail?
Well, it entailed photographing the general quite a bit. It entailed also doing some training films. I was in the Air Photographic Squadron that did a lot of training films in the United States. That's how I started, actually.
Started making movies.
Yeah.
John Frankenheimer, director of the original Manchurian Candidate, speaking to Terry Gross in 1990. He died in 2002 at age 72.